Hi, and welcome to another Canny Conversations podcast, powered by the Pathway Group. My name's Mark Wakeley, and I'm one of the team who bring you these podcasts each week. In this series, Sarfraz Ali will be talking to some of the business people he has met and worked with in his 23 years at the heart of the West Midlands business community, and of course many of the businesses that are part of the Multicultural Apprenticeship Alliance. This week, we'll be rejoining Sarfraz's conversation with Jill Whittaker, the Executive Chair of HIT Training. In this second half, Jill continues to share her journey and wisdom, emphasising the importance of listening, continuous learning, and surrounding oneself with talented individuals. She reflects on her organisation's achievements, including being recognised as one of the top companies to work for in the UK. Jill also touches on the future of the sector, highlighting the need for inclusivity and talent development. So join us as we explore Jill's remarkable insight and experiences in leadership, education, and social justice. So let's rejoin the conversation.
If I can bring you back to, if I may, the sector, the industry, the hospitality industry, I mean, because some people misunderstand, you know, what that means. It's a broad sort of catch-all title a little bit as well. So talk to us a little bit about some of those misunderstandings and misconceptions about the hospitality sector, if you may.
What we think of as the hospitality is very broad and very deep. So it's everything from the Michelin-starred restaurant and the five-star hotel to the kebab shop on the corner and the takeaway. And it's the whole of public sector catering comes within that sector too. So I was very much honoured to be recognised as one of the influencers in the public sector catering this year. And I was talking to a number of public sector caterers, and there you've got the breadth too. So you have the fine dining kitchens at the House of Commons, and you have National Health caterers who are trying to provide nutritional meals for £2.20. And so you, again, deep and broad. So when we talk about the hospitality industry, how do we attract people to the hospitality industry? I think we have to step back a little bit and say which bit of the hospitality industry we're talking about.
Yeah, because more defined,
Because we've all got different problems. You know, I mentioned earlier the general manager at the five-star hotel who's talking about bringing in people with, she needs receptionists language. With language skills.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about public sector catering in hospitals, they need to train their staff to understand nutrition on a budget. So budgetary control, nose to tail or plant to fork eating, minimum waste, maximum value, maximum efficiency, maximum nutrition, all of those things are going to be really important in their skills programs. Perhaps the nutritional element is less important if you're looking at a Michelin-starred restaurant because people aren't necessarily going there for nutrition. They're going there for experience. So we need to look at the breadth of it as well as the depth of that industry to understand the challenges that it's up against at the moment. Even if you think about the pub sector, that too is very broad. You've got everything from the small village pub with no food offer to places that have, you might call them inns, you know, coaching inns where they have rooms. So they have a room offer like a small hotel. They've got a restaurant offer.
Yeah.
They have every job that you can think of in that whole sector.
Just reading up about this, I mean, I didn't know this, the fact that it's one of the biggest industries and sectors in the UK, third biggest, according to some of
the... Bigger than manufacturing, engineering and automotive put together, together.
Absolutely.
My good friend Kate Nichols puts that statistic out there on a regular basis, and it's true.
So some
it's huge.
Big data out there in terms of, you know, the numbers and people that have come in. Some people still see it as not as a career. Some see it as a job as opposed to a lifelong career, as some aspects of it. So if you were talking to somebody about the hospitality sector, how would you describe it in terms of job opportunities and work opportunities?
I think it's that breadth and depth that is really important. It's a very interesting sector. It enables you to travel the world. It's transferable skills that individuals can pick up and not only build their own career, but also support support the efficiency of the organisations in which they operate. It's very team focused. Most of hospitality is a team-based model, and that's great for people who like working with other people. So there's a lot of breadth and depth there. There's a lot of opportunity there. One of the reasons that we don't hear an awful lot about hospitality is that it just feels like careers teachers in schools don't really talk about it very much. But I think part of that is that other than hospitality degrees or hotelier degrees, there isn't really that sort of offer at the moment. So one of the things that we've been very keen to explore and are exploring at the moment is a degree apprenticeship offer to attract young talents to compete with all of the other sectors out there who are absolutely bringing in young talent through degree apprenticeship. So, for example, my son, one of my son's best friends is currently undertaking a degree apprenticeship in cybersecurity. Very bright lad, one of the brightest kids in the school, went in straight after A-levels. So 4 years later, he's just completing his degree. He's got an extraordinary job. He's bought his first flat. You know, that's the sort of thing that can happen if you really engage in your education and in the workplace at the same time. Absolutely. So we want to see that opportunity for people in hospitality and in care roles as well.
Fantastic. Appreciate you sharing that. In terms of, you know, the future for the sector and so forth, I mean, obviously it's gone through a tough ride. There's been a lot of changes there. I mean, it's gone from a sort of a survival mindset now to sort of excelling, thriving and so forth. Generally, what's the outlook for the future for specifically the sector, the hospitality sector?
In the hospitality sector, it's still very challenging. I mean, there's no getting away from it. Returning to the sort of levels that business was at prior to the last few years. Yeah. I don't want to keep going on about COVID, but you cannot underestimate the impact that has had, and so many organisations have gone out of business over that period of time. And you can see it in look at our client relationship management system and the amount of turnover, the amount of flux in there is extraordinary. However, things are starting to move in a better direction. Mm. I read all the trade press and everything I'm reading at the moment. An awful lot of businesses who are saying, you know, it's been tough, but we're starting to turn that corner. And I think a lot of it has been that realization that without the people, without investing in their people, then they're not going to be able to achieve what it is that they're at. And so, you know, increasing the volumes of people that they're offering skills training, skills development to, growing your own talent. There was a long period of time over Brexit, won't it happen? Yeah. Oh, it's not going to make any difference to us. Mm. And then there was, well, they're going to have to do something and let more people in. And now there is the realisation that none of that's going to happen. So we've got to grow our own. We've got to grow our own talent. Mm. We have to develop our own talent pools, whether that is encouraging people into your organisation by offering them a future and a career, or whether it's by taking the people who are already working for you and spending time with them and understanding what their aspirations are and how you can develop them to deliver what it is that you need as a business.
Absolutely. I mean, the challenges are still there. I mean, cost of living, you know, crisis, that's still here. Mm. You know, you've got the utility sort of cost prices that are just going through the roof. I mean, the challenges are there.
You've got VAT as well. VAT. I mean, you're competing against somebody who can go down to the supermarket and pick up half a dozen cans of beer. There's no way that if you've got an establishment, you can ever compete with that sort of price. Yeah. And so when things are tight, they'll take their drinks home with them. They'll make their own food and they'll take it home with them. They won't be spending it out there. So that is well recognised, well understood. And that's why, you know, the hospitality industry is so flexible. They bend over backwards to try and, you know, to bring clients in, to make them happy, to give them a better experience. The better experience you have, the more likely you are to go back again. So that's where the investment is going, and giving people a great experience, making them feel good so they want to do it more.
Yeah. So a lot of this is really in developing the staff, you know, their customer service skills, their ability to really manage, people, manage talent, bring talent on board and really retain the investment that they've made with people. So
it's not enough to just have fantastic food or a brilliant wine offering. That's not enough. Mm. What you have to do is you have to create an experience. People will forget what they had to drink and what they had to eat, but they'll never forget how you made them feel. And that's what organisations have to do. You've got to make people feel special and they'll choose to spend their money with you.
I think that's a very memorable point there as well. It is about the experiences, isn't it? And the experience, you can't have that without the people, and it's the people and exactly. It's your team that's going to be there. So
I would say that, Zach, we haven't got a sausage machine. maybe I should have got a sausage machine instead. Life would have been simpler, right? But as it is, all we've got is people.
So thank you for sharing that. I want to talk a little bit more about your good self as well, in terms of your role as a sort of accountant and how that's come in. So we'll transition a little bit in terms of Jill Whittaker, the person, really the professional. So the people out there who are sort of one of our target audiences is people who are in the HR field, and another one is people who are sort of looking and seeking careers advice and potentially looking to grow their career. You spoke about your son, and you spoke about other people previously in terms of how they've sort of transitioned. So talk a little bit about how that journey has been, and what sort of advice would you give to people out there? It doesn't have to be young people, just people out there who are looking at sort of developing professionally.
That's a really interesting thought process I've got to go through there, Seth. So I stayed on at sixth form, did A-levels, and I was quite good at maths. So I did maths and further maths. And I also did French and art. So I had a bit of a broad spectrum there. But everyone else in my further maths group went to university. I was the only person who didn't want to, and I had no interest in it. Took entrance exams for some of the higher colleges and passed them, but didn't really want to go. Wasn't very interested in it. It was something I just had my head focused on, getting into the workplace and getting some money. Not that we were particularly poor people, but we weren't particularly well off, and I just really wanted to get on with life rather than spending more of it being educated, which I was pretty bored with by then, to be honest. And my mechanics teacher was a smashing chap. And he couldn't believe this and didn't understand it. And his whole life had been in academia, and he had no concept of any individual ever having done further maths A level and then not going to university. He didn't get in. He took me to one side and he tried to talk me out of it. I said no. So he said, look, I've got a friend who works in an accountancy practice in Birmingham. Let me introduce you. Then that might be the right route for you. So introduce me, and this chap was a smashing guy, ended up being my training partner. And he said, you're going to have to go and do a year at what used to be Polytechnic. That's how old I am. It's prior to everything being called a university. So I got sent along to the Lanchester Polytechnic in Coventry for a year, did a foundation program, and then 4 years of training to become an accountant. And the thing about that training back then was you got to see all sorts of businesses and got to understand how they worked. So not just the numbers, it wasn't just about processing numbers and doing sums. And a lot of people think about accountants as if they're mathematicians, and they're not necessarily, and I was, but not everyone is. It's about using those numbers to understand the business. Mm-hmm. And I love that. It was fantastic. And so what that gave me is an insight into how businesses worked. Mm-hmm. So I went from, when I finished that, I worked internationally for a few years, and I went off to Bermuda and worked in offshore insurance for a couple of years, which was nice. And I did a lot of yacht racing while I was there. And at the end of that time, I delivered a yacht to America. Spent some time traveling, got back to the UK and got a job with a bank, which I absolutely detested. It was horrendous. It was the guy who was running the department was clearly building an empire, and he gave me a piece of work and said it would probably take 4 or 5 days. And I took it back in about 3 hours and said I'd done it. And he said, no, you didn't understand. I want you to make it last 4 or 5 days. It was just shocking. I couldn't stand it. At that time, my sister had just got a job working for a company in the mountains. And I thought, actually, that's what I should do. So I went and I found a chef's job in French Alps and went and did that for a little while. I ran a bar for a couple of years and thoroughly enjoyed it. And when I finished that, I came back to the UK, did some relief work for the RAC. One of their senior finance people was off on a sabbatical, so I covered for them. And then I went and got on a yacht and sailed to Australia. And that's where I met my husband in the French canals. We met in Lyon. That's the rest is history. So when I got back to the UK, I worked for a while with various different organisations, and then eventually saw a job advertised that looked really interesting. It was in a training provider. Well, they were called training companies then. I don't think they called them training providers then, but they did apprenticeships and diplomas, mostly in the hospitality industry. They were called Hospitality Plus, and John Hyde, my Jai CBE, my dear colleague, was the managing director at the time. And I went for the interview, got the job, and the rest is history, really. So that's how I ended up in the education sector, more by accident than design, because I was in car engineering and design prior to that. The whole thing with that was, you know, the understanding the business quite quickly, being able to get my head around it quite fast, and seeing where there were some challenges within that business model, and immediately spending time with John. John will be the first person to tell you that is not his skill set. He is extraordinarily an enigmatic character. He is a great leader of people. He facilitates so much, and he's got an extraordinary brain. He's really visionary, but he needs somebody holding onto his ankles to stop him. So he needs somebody with the financial acumen to make things really, really work together. Yeah. So the two of us were such a team from day one. When I went in there, looked at his accounts and said, right, we've got some work to do here, pal, because this isn't going in the right direction at the moment. And after some strong words, we settled down and we got on with it, and we turned that business into something fantastic. And that was bought out by VT, which became Babcock a couple of years later. And then eventually we'd moved in other directions, and John phoned me and said, do you want to go again? Shall we start something else? So, yeah, we're almost 18 years into a five-year plan now.
Wow. I love that, yeah. Yeah, so fantastic.
So I think it's that doing that accountancy piece, I've worked across loads of industries. I've worked in hospitality. I've worked in construction. I've worked in the legal profession. There's not many industries that I haven't really had a bit of an insight into throughout my career. And that's been fabulous, because it just, your brain takes on a lot, and it has to be able to see through to the critical success points in the organisation. So I hopefully that's been my main skill set, is being able to get to the crux of what is the challenge here, and how do we need to get past the issues we've got? Because, you know, you've got to start off with where it is you want to go, and then work out where you are before you can start the pathway to getting there. Yeah. And that clarity of vision, I think, came from that accountancy. It's very rigorous accountancy training. You know, I'm a chartered accountant, one of God's own children.
Yeah.
And, it is rigorous. It doesn't mean you're always going to be an accountant. I've got lots of friends who've gone down that pathway and ended up in business, business, in banking.
Yeah.
Finance, doing all sorts of different roles.
So, Jill, I mean, it's fantastic to hear the journey and hear the path that's got you here. But what advice would you give to sort of young leaders or aspiring leaders and also entrepreneurs looking to sort of make that impact in any field, you know, not necessarily hospitality or the sector that we're in, but any sector out there?
I think the best piece of advice that anybody ever gave me is, you've got two ears and one mouth for a reason.
Okay. So you listen.
Be a good listener.
Be a good listener. You'll hear the opportunities. You'll see what that is. Yeah. And you'll learn from others, really.
You'll have come across Stephen Covey and his seven habits and all of that. And I know some people think it's a bit old hat, but one of Stephen Covey's habits, seven habits, is first seek to understand, then to be understood. In that order. And that would be the best piece of advice I would give people. Also, try to find something you love that makes you feel good. Once I found this learning and development sector, once I found apprenticeships, then, you know, that we're talking about 26 years that I've been in this sector now.
Yeah.
And once you find something you really, really love, then, you know, put your heart and soul into it. And surround yourself by people who are cleverer than you. Yeah, John Hyde always says that his greatest success was surrounding himself by, clever women, actually. But surrounding himself by people cleverer than him. People who know stuff that you don't. And not yes men. You don't want people who are going to challenge you. You want people who are going to really keep you on your toes.
I mean, talking about women, you were voted one of the top women in hospitality, you know, with number of lists that come out there, and your name keeps coming up in when they talk about women and leadership and hospitality and the FE sector and so forth. So talk to us a little bit about some of the challenges, if there are any challenges, as a woman in leadership roles?
That's a difficult one, Saf, because never having been a bloke, yeah. I'm really struggling to answer that one. I think one of the funny things for me is that people are always a bit shocked at how little I am. Yeah. In fact, I have one really good friend who I've known for years.
Yeah.
After about 4 or 5 years, suddenly said to me, "Good God, how tall are you?" Well, I said, "Well, I'm about 5'3" and a bit." Yeah, and that's ridiculous. You're a foot shorter than me. He hadn't noticed.
Oh, God.
No, perhaps we spent most of our time sitting down. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, I really don't. I mean, I was very lucky. I was one of three sisters. I'm the eldest. So the boss, probably the bossiest, probably. And I said to my dad once when I was about 12 or 13, you know, Did you never want any sons? And he said, he looked at me and really quizzically and said, "Well, what could a boy do that you can't?"
Yeah.
So we were brought up with that in mind. It never crossed my mind that I couldn't do anything just because I was a woman. And I still find it a bit shocking sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. One of my very good friends, Jane Knight, has a fabulous organisation called Successful Mums.
Yeah.
You probably know her, Saf. Yeah. And she's a real powerhouse. And one of the reasons she started it was when she went back to work after her kids as a professional, she just felt as though perhaps she was on the back foot a little bit and other women would feel the same. So she started this great organisation. She told me about one of her colleagues the other day, one of her clients. This lady was a barrister, brain the size of, you know, a planet, extraordinary. But after she had her kids, she was just, this imposter syndrome thing came in, this old piece around, you know, I'm not worthy, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, really shocking. So Jane's done some fantastic work around that. It's not something that I've personally ever suffered from, really.
Jill, I mean, you're a person that's sort of embraced lifelong learning, continuous sort of professional development, continuously learning, and not just learning in terms of books and so forth, but learning from others, you know, being part of sort of discussions and sharing ideas and so forth. Recognized as IOD, Institute of Directors, Director of the Year, being involved with various sort of stakeholder groups and so forth. How much of that has been, in your view, part of that sort of success or the ingredients?
I just think you can't operate in a vacuum. If you want to get the best out of life, personally and professionally, then you've got to surround yourself by people. You've got to surround yourself by challenges.
Yeah.
You know, people who think differently to you, people who are different to you are the best people you can learn from. I have this discussion with my husband. He's got some strong political views, and that's fine. I don't have any issue with that. But that he kind of almost likes to surround himself by people who share the same views.
Okay.
Which I find bizarre.
Groupthink takes place.
Yeah, bit bizarre. I'd much rather have a good, robust conversation with somebody that I don't necessarily agree with. One of my very best friends is at the opposite end of the political spectrum to me, couldn't be further apart, and we laugh so much because you can't, you know, you've got to be open to other pictures of the world.
You've got to be stretching your challenges to a certain level in terms
of, all going to have different pictures of the world, and it's formed out of it's formed out of everything, isn't it? It's formed out of where you grew up and then
our lived experiences, all of those sort of things.
Yeah, which also is all stuff you read. Yeah, you know, I mean, one of my favourite books, and amusingly, when my really good friend Keith Knowles gave me a copy of this book, and I've read this book, and every time, I don't know if you've ever read a book called Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
No.
Oh, read it. It's a 2-hour read. It's a very small book. It's absolutely wonderful. It's about a seagull. He wants to fly as high as can be.
Okay.
Yeah, and it is just warms your heart. It is absolutely wonderful. It's a very little book. Yeah, my dear friend Keith gave me a copy of it recently, and historically I picked it up, read it, and handed it on to someone else. And this one, he said, "This one you've got to keep because you need this for yourself." But I would recommend that to anybody. So things you read, they colour your judgment as well. And people you meet and experiences that you have. So don't hide away. Don't be that person who lives online. Get out there and go and see people, see stuff and do stuff.
Do stuff.
Do things.
Yeah,
go skiing.
Yeah.
Yeah. that kind of thing.
Okay. So I love some numbers and lists and so forth. I mean, not only, you know, have you been recognized as a sort of IOD Director of the Year, but a top 100 female within a number of awards, but the organization itself has been listed as Sunday Times top 100 best companies to work for. How did that come about and how does that make you feel? Obviously, it's a massive achievement.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's fantastic. So one of the things about that is, you know, you do a survey of your staff, and we had one of the highest response rates from our staff the last time we did it. We don't do it every year because it's quite an expensive, time-consuming process.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the last time that we did it, we had one of the highest response rates of all of the companies that had entered into this. And we came, I think, 17th out of the top 100 companies to work for in the UK, which was... Oh, absolutely. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And hearing some of the things that people say about you, that it's a useful process, though, Saf. And I'd recommend it to organisations of all sizes. And as I say, it's quite expensive, and there are other sort of recording methodologies that you can use to get that sort of information. You can get quite granular. So say you've got a team of 10 people. They will feed into how you operate as a leader within the organisation.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can look at how the leaders in your organisation are recognised, as well as the organisation overall.
Yeah.
And then obviously there was feedback about the chief executive at that time. That was me.
Okay.
I did all right on that. I did all right. I mean, you know, I can't expect everyone to love you. And my job isn't to be loved.
Yeah.
It's to be respected.
To do the right thing, yeah. And talking about the job and doing the right thing and so forth, I mean, one of the things that I know notice in terms of your career is that, you know, you have a continuously being involved with other organizations in a non-executive capacity. So you've been sitting on boards, being that sort of advisor and being involved in that governance process. I mean, as I said, you were a IOD Director of the Year, you're a professional director with the experiences of being an accountant and also the entrepreneurial element of it. And then you've contributed to other organizations as a non-exec, as a sort of a member of the board. Tell us a little bit about that transition and, you know, wearing that hat, and how does that change from the day job to a certain level?
No, the only other, at the moment, the only other board position that I've got is AELP.
Yeah.
Our trade association for training providers.
Which John was a founder of.
Absolutely. When it was AELP.
ALP, back in the day. Yeah.
And before that, they had a small group. They used to call themselves the G10, which I always used to joke about being a bit grand, guys.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
But that was the group of the 10 larger training providers. Because John and back then a number of the other leaders in the sector, they recognised that there wasn't really any representation for the sector. There was nothing out there really. So they formed that, and that was good. I really enjoy being part of the ALP board. Again, that's something, we're mostly about apprenticeships and more recently higher technical qualifications as well, moving into the degree piece and all of that. The board is, very broad.
Yeah.
People from all sorts of backgrounds and different types of organisations. So we've got colleges there, we've got not-for-profit, we've got small providers, large providers, medium-sized, endpoint assessment organisations, awarding organisations. So again, you know, for me, it's really interesting to be able to apply my knowledge and understanding and to help to support development for the broader sector rather than just the bit that I'm already in. So that's been really helpful. But in the past, I had a consultancy business and was non-executive director for all sorts of different organisations.
Many organisations in terms of...
Loads of different stuff. You know, used to work with one organiser, a charity in Eastbourne that worked with people who had become deaf, so deafened people as opposed to people born deaf. That, again, very broad, quantity surveyors, all sorts of different businesses.
I mean,
really.
I can reel off a list here. I mean, there's dozens of them, there's scores of them, really. So I can reel off a list here. But many, many sort of diversified sort of sectors and so forth. And, you know, you're sitting on, in some cases, you know, for a number of years. And in other cases, probably shorter, just maybe... helping them with projects or turning the business around.
It's about keeping your brain agile, isn't it?
I
do think I'm a great believer in non-executive directorships as a support for businesses there's no better pair of eyes than the one that sees you as you are.
Yeah.
And I think in business, quite often, we can get our noses against that grindstone and we can't see very far. Yeah. And things become, well, that's what we do around here. That's how we do things around here. And as a non-exec, you can go and you can ask the stupid question. You can say, well, why? Why do you do things that way? Or I don't understand why you do this. Please, can you explain it to
me?
But sometimes you find that actually they're only doing things that way because that's what they've done for years. And it's just normal.
Yeah.
That's their normal.
Yeah.
And actually, that's really valuable for me now, going back to my current role as exec chair. It gives me the opportunity, without the managerial responsibility, it gives me the opportunity to stand back a bit and ask some of those really ridiculous questions and helping us to recognise and understand where we sometimes aren't doing as well as we could or why things aren't working as we would like them to. Because mostly things are okay. But, you know, it's really useful to be able to stand back and look at things in that way. And I was having that conversation with one of my colleagues the other day because, you know, one of the things that we do at HIT, which, you know, drives around the bend, is kind of we meddle a bit with things. We, you know, we don't buy a piece of software and say, this is what this piece of software does, let's use it for that purpose. We look at it and we go, oh, I wonder if you could just do that one extra thing. And I don't think that's necessarily a great idea. Sometimes that's it's a bit naive. You're always trying to bend things to fit you.
Yeah.
Perhaps they're not going to work as well as they were intended in the first place. So, yeah. That non-exec position or the non-full-time without the responsibilities is really, I think it adds value. It adds value to businesses of all size.
Yeah. I mean, Jill, one of the things that, I mean, I've known you for is really being that that voice for social mobility. You've always spoken about it before it even became fashion, really, to a certain level in terms of social mobility, giving people opportunity, diversity, equity, inclusion. You know, you've signed up to the Multicultural Apprenticeship Alliance. We thank you for that. We really appreciate you coming on board as a patron. We needed organizations like yourself to be involved and support the Alliance and do that. But you've been doing a lot of work, as I said, for many, many years and so forth. So talk to us a little bit about some of those initiatives and your beliefs in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, and the whole social mobility agenda. Really.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody should have the opportunity to raise their own level of skills, knowledge, understanding to the place where they feel comfortable and happy. And that should be completely irrelevant of your background, of your disabilities, of your social standing and your social status when you start. I think social justice is what we should be talking about because I think there's value, huge value, and also with apprenticeships, for example. It doesn't matter to me whether you do your intermediate apprenticeship and you want to be absolutely brilliant at that and that is where you stay, or whether you want to take it all the way through to a level 7, to a master's level, and to be the boss of the company. To me, it doesn't matter either way. What matters is you have the opportunity to reach wherever you wish to reach, irrelevant of any social standing background, any diversity issue. It just shouldn't be relevant. It shouldn't. I can't even believe we're still talking about that. Can you? Really, though, Saf? I mean, seriously, can you? I mean, one of the great things about these podcasts and hearing things, I'm a great listener of the radio. I love the radio.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. And part of the reason why I love the radio is you can't see the people. So you have no opinion. No one has any opinion. You might have an opinion about their accent. She sounds like she might be from Birmingham. You know, then you might have an opinion about that. Or you might say, oh, that sounds like it's probably a female.
Yeah.
But you don't know. You don't know. I could be 6'2". I could be, you don't know. I could be any of those things and you wouldn't have an opinion about me.
Yeah.
And then as soon as we see people, some individuals start to form opinions.
Yeah.
And I'm not okay with that. You know, we need to find a way of being truly inclusive and genuinely believing that. And the only way we're ever going to do it is to educate it into our kids and live it, live that experience.
And that's probably one of the reasons why some of these music shows like The Voice and so forth have taken off, because it is, you're just listening to the actual craft of the singing as opposed to the look and the feel and so forth. So I think there's something in there.
There was a wonderful, I don't know if you listened to Radio 4 at all. I love Radio 4. I'm not going to talk about the Archers, by the way, so you're all right. But I think it was Michelle Hussein was interviewing somebody.
Okay.
There was somebody who phoned in on one of the Saturday morning phoning programs and was started to talk about, well, they're coming here to our country. And then you could hear, you know, that nasty racist thing that you can hear it coming in. And she said, when you say they, who do you mean? He said, well, you know, them. She said, oh, do you mean me? Do you mean us? It was brilliant. The person at the other end just stopped. Oh, I've got this wrong, haven't I? But they had really got it wrong. And it was just awful and embarrassing. But she absolutely, she was brilliant. Oh, you mean me? And that whole thing, people like us, like when somebody says, oh, people like us, what do you mean by people like us? Because we're all people like us.
Jill, my final sort of trying to bring this to a little bit of a close. We've had a fantastic, fantastic conversation. And, you know, to be frank with you, it's, we've discussed quite a few things. Some of them in a bit more detail than normally. Sometimes we have these conversations there as well, which is fantastic, which is great. I want to try and, if I can, you talk about sort of next steps, really, in terms of the future and some of that aspect of it. And you said earlier on, you know, 18 years into your 5-year plan in terms of that. You've had this change as well now. You're an executive chair. You've reduced your sort of working time to a certain level, 3 days a week. But I know how difficult that can be at times as well, because, you know, you're so part of that DNA of that organization. Your identity is within the business, and you are at times being bought into too many things, and you're having to probably say no to quite a few things now. You've got a team that, you know, you've been sort of, but you've done part of that succession planning as well. So talk to us a little bit about where you are now and what does that future look like for yourself, for the organization, and also for the sector. So there's a few things there that I've just thrown at you. Take that as it is, really. Where's the future for yourself, for the business, the businesses, and for the sector? Is there a reason for optimism? Is can you share some optimism?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some change coming that we don't know what it looks like yet. The noise from all political parties at the moment is around some form of apprenticeship levy reform. So extending that out. Now, it strikes me that during apprenticeship last week, in conversation with Robert Halfen and others, there was a lot of talk about higher technical qualifications. There was a lot of talk about multiply. There was talk about T levels and apprenticeships. And they were the main topics.
Okay.
So you expect it to be all about apprenticeships, but no. Yeah. There was talk about all of those other things as well. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if the levy reform is less of a reform and more of a let's use the money for doing some other things as well, specific qualifications and everything. It feels to me as though that might be coming. And there still is that sort of, Robert talks about his ladder of opportunity. There's still a lot of work to be done around that opportunity piece. My great hope is that that pilot that I mentioned to you earlier that we've been working on will enable lots of people who would previously have been excluded from apprenticeships to be able to take part and to be able to build their skills. My hope is that as a nation, we finally get our heads around the fact that you don't have to get all your education when you're a kid.
Yeah.
You know, we can get it at any age. In the past, we've had apprentices in their 60s, 70s even. Yeah. You know, people who've still got a lot to give.
Yeah.
And on a personal level, I would say, you know, there's life in the old dog. She's still around. I might be 60 years old, but I'm still, having had both my knees replaced, I'm intending to wear them out as quickly as I possibly can. So, you know, there's still a lot more that I can give to the sector. Yeah. And there's a lot of informal stuff that I think is really valuable. I go along to people's conferences and I do a lot of networking, a lot of talking. But over the years, lots of people have worked for me or I've worked alongside them, and many of them still pick up the phone and they just have a little half an hour chat. You know, they've come across a problem or a challenge that they've had in the past. And it's not something that we do formally or pay for or anything like that. It's just if you've got 20 minutes, because I really need to talk to somebody who I know isn't going to go and shout it from the rooftops, who's going to give me a bit of advice. And I hope that I can carry on doing that sort of thing as well. I think because as you say, I'm reasonably well known. People know who I am in the sector. And I think being approachable as well, then being able to help other people is great. And I'm privileged. I'm really privileged. I've had a fantastic career. I work in a sector which I absolutely adore. I give back to the hospitality and care sectors that have given me this facility to be who I am. And, I'm a really lucky woman.
Really, Jill, honestly, it's always a privilege and fantastic to spend a bit of time with you. And from my perspective, as I said, you were right at the beginning, you know, my sort of first public foray into public speaking. You were there, you were holding my hand, and I said to my son as well that, you know, my first time that I did something, I was completely out of my comfort zone, and you sort of really supported me, and I can never forget that. And every single time I meet with you, I always remind you the fact that you were there, and I thank you for that, and I thank you for your support.
You have to keep doing things that frighten yourself.
Yeah, you've got to keep sort of pushing, really, and you've got to keep challenging yourself, and you need people around you to provide that little bit of a challenge, and also to a certain level that you can sort of see what they're doing, and as a result of that, you know, you get inspired, and you are, as I said, you have been that inspired. It's been an honor for me to spend a bit of time with you, but also at the same time, thank you formally once again for your contribution to the sector. From my perspective, I'm a nobody, but I want to thank you from my perspective, and also your contribution to the diversity, equity, inclusion, and social mobility agenda by signing up to become a patron for the Multicultural Apprenticeship Alliance. I want to wish you well with the pilot. As I said, it's really sounds like a game changer and a big deal, particularly in terms of functional skills and allowing people to do an apprenticeship, you know, without some of those high-level barriers, unnecessary barriers. I think it's fantastic as well in terms of the organization moving, transitioning into sort of employee ownership model, which I think is really, really innovative. And if anybody isn't aware of that, I think that's something that they should generally, you know, research and Google. I think is a fantastic model, and it differentiates the organization considerably from others. And I think there's a lot more of that people are going to be hearing. So from my perspective, you know, you've been very supportive to us, been very supportive and cheerleading the sector, the further education skill sector, particularly independent training providers, but also the key sectors that you're involved with, which, you know, have gone through a tremendous challenge to, you know, the hospitality sector, of course, the adult apprenticeship sector and the childcare sector. So I'll pass the ball back to yourself in terms of final words of wisdom and anything you wish to say just to wrap up our podcast today.
Just to say it's been an absolute pleasure. It's always good to spend time with you. It's a joy to be able to support the Multicultural Apprenticeship Alliance and equity and diversity more generally. And thank you.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you.
Thanks to Jill Whittaker, the Executive Chair at HIT Training Limited, for her insight and time. Next week, Safraz will be in conversation with Sue Thexton, Managing Director of OneFile. So if you don't want to miss that, then remember to subscribe or follow us. If you're new to the podcast, let me tell you, there are already 85 other Canny Conversations podcast episodes out there, and you can hear all those past episodes by searching for Canny Conversation on your preferred podcast platform, or go to 1386audio.com/ have a listen. We'd also love it if you could review, subscribe, or follow the podcast. And please tell your friends and colleagues about us. If you'd like to know more, then go to cannyconversationspodcast.co.uk or go to Safraz's website. That's safraz.co.uk. Safraz has also written a series of easy-to-follow business books, Canny Bites. These are available from cannybites.co.uk/buy-the-book. As I said, we'll be back next week, where you'll be able to hear the first half of Safraz's conversation with Sue Thexton, Managing Director of OneFile. So until then, we hope you have a good week.
This is a 1386 audio production.